There's a web address there. If once is not enough for you, that's where you can see the text, though not the clips, though they're pretty much all on YouTube somewhere. Historians of dance are agreed that tap originates in a confluence, on the one hand, of Northern European rural dance traditions, instanced in the Irish and Scottish jig, for example, and Northern English clog dance, with, on the other hand, African styles of dance retained and developed by slaves in American plantations. Tap retains from both of these currents, of course, the gravitational pull, the orientation towards the ground. The great Eleanor Powell recounts that when she first began to learn tap dance, having previously learned to a very high level ballet, her coach, Jack Donahue, told her, "You're very aerial. In tap, you've got to get down to the floor." Donahue came up with a surprisingly direct way of discouraging Eleanor Powell's balletic levitations. She says that he had a war surplus belt, the kind you put bullets in. There weren't any bullets, but on each side of the belt there were two sandbags, the kind they used to weigh down the curtains in a theatre. "I want you to know, with that belt on, I couldn't move off the floor, and I haven't moved off the floor since." T.S. Eliot captures the clumping, the chthonic quality of the contact of foot and ground, of course, in country and traditional dances, in this well-known passage from East Coker. "Round and round the fire, leaping through the flames, or joined in circles, rustically solemn, or in rustic laughter, lifting heavy shoe feet in clumsy shoes, earth feet, loam feet, lifted in country mirth, mirth of those long since under earth, nourishing the corn, keeping time, feet rising and falling, eating and drinking, dung and death." Of course, the evolution of tap, of which cinema really shows only the most perfected forms, is away from this kind of mortal shuffling. In becoming urban and sophisticated, tap had to minimise its contact with the ground. The values of lightness and flight had to prevail over the clinging cyclicities of country dances like this one. At the same time, the strongly vertical or pile-drivingly perpendicular orientations of country dances, think of Irish step dances or primitivist reflexes like punk pogoing, in which all the energy is driven down towards the ground and recoils in the same column away from it, these are varied by lateral and radial movements. Most importantly and definingly for tap, the upper body, the head and the arms, are recruited to the dance. Where in the earlier style that was known as buck and wing, the stamp is primary and the little flutters and kicks, named after the flutter of the pigeon wing, are snatched ornamentations, in fully fledged tap, the aim is to suggest an airborne dancer who grazes and pecks at the ground only in passing. Tap is a kind of tact. Cinema assists in this elevation of tap through a kind of pun, whereby the light, fantastic toe merges with the evanescence of the flickering light that is the matter of cinema. And the recoil from the ground also has drearily predictable class and race analogies. As tap dance dwelled less and less on the earth, so it was also lifted up in the social and racial scales. As the shifty clodhoppings of the rural folk dance gave way to the sophisticated struts and high kicks of urban dance, the clumping clown became the prancing toff, kitted out in spats, top hat, and tails. In large part, this movement also meant a move from black dancers to white, although purist historians of dance will still often prefer the loose-limbed, downward focus of a Bill Bojangles Robinson to the exorbitant soarings and scissorings of an Astaire, a Donald O'Connor, or
Gene Kelly. However, we might note that the air walking associated with the aristocratic tap dancer appears not second in the history of tap, but actually first in the farcical high steppings of what is called the cakewalk, in which white slave owners saw, or maybe failed to see, their own dance movements mimicked and mocked by their slaves. I wasn't able to embed my clips, so I'm going to have rather awkwardly to move between these. So here's a film by Edison of a cakewalk inserted into his film of Uncle Tom's Cabin. It's silent. And very jolly, I think you'll agree. Adorno predictably saw the cakewalk and tap dancing, I need to give you another quotation here, as the survivals of the original lament of unfreedom, which jazz never managed to transfigure. For, he says, everything unruly in it was from the very beginning integrated into a strict scheme. Its rebellious gestures are accompanied by the tendency to blind obeisance, much like the sadomasochistic type described by analytic psychology. The person who chafes against the father figure while secretly admiring him, who seeks to emulate him and in turn derives enjoyment from the subordination he overtly detests. This seems to be redoubled for Adorno in the adoption of jazz by the white lumpen proletariat, or as we should perhaps call them, the klumpen proletariat, who participated in its prehistory during the period preceding its thrust, jazz this is, into the spotlight of a society which seemed to be waiting for it and which had long been familiar with its impulses through the cakewalk and tap dancing. I think the only mention of tap dancing in Adorno, you have it. Clement Greenberg saw tap dance as one of the elements of kitsch, that assembly of, as he described them, chromotypes, magazine covers, illustrations, ads, slick and pulp fictions, comics, Tin Pan Alley music, tap dancing, Hollywood music, etc., etc., that entertained the recent peasants who swarmed into cities to make up the proletariat and petit bourgeoisie, who had, he said, been educated to the point of being able to read and write, but had not the leisure to develop any really cultivated kind of sensibility. Tap dance is a kind of thwarted or crippled transcendence for these writers. But this, in a different sense from that meant by this austere kind of anti-modern modernism of Adorno and Greenberg, is for me precisely the point of tap. Tap dance reminds cinema of its origins in the turn of the century vernaculars of vaudeville, circus, carnival, and other diffuse kinds of attractions and spectacles. One can, I think, make out in the difference between the smooth, aerial flights of a Fred Astaire and the earthier moves of a Bill Robinson a rhyme with this struggle between the technical sophistication of the cinema in its developed form and its lowlier, more vulgarly corporeal origins and appetites. The contrast between the clog-dancing rustic, whether black or Irish, and the sophisticated boulevardier testifies to a class ambivalence that is never quite resolved in tap dance, which always retains the traces of its ostentatiously corporeal origins and a kind of comic awkwardness that resists being sublated into the condition of high art. Eleanor Powell relates how she had to say to a stiffly over-polite Astaire, "Now listen, fundamentally we're hoofers, right? We're the act that opens first with the flea circus. You may be the great Mr. Astaire and all that, but we're still hoofers, so can we get down to Ellie and Fred?" For all the air of sophistication of cinema's headline exponents of tap, Tap reminds Cinnabar of its origin in the display of novelties and curiosities, what Tom Gunning has called the cinema of attractions. Tap dance always acts like a kind of decomposition of cinema to its primal elements of sound and movement, most importantly in its play with the mechanization of human bodies. Tap dance therefore provides an elementary form of cinema's transactions between body and image, gravity and light. Tap dance has another legacy from slavery in the intense focus that it retains on labour. The gratuitous exhilaration of tap is always, it seems, earned by toil and fatigue. Julian Marsh, the director in Busby Berkeley's 42nd Street, famously barks at his cast, "We're going to rehearse for 5 weeks, and we're going to open on scheduled time. And I mean scheduled time. You're going to work and sweat and work some more. You're going to work days and you're going to work nights. And you're going to work between time when I think you need it. You're going to dance until your feet fall off and you're not able to stand up any longer. But 5 weeks from now, we're going to have a show." Adorno is certainly right to see the leisure of tap dance grimly twinned with labour. And this labour is of an increasingly industrial kind, consisting of hours of regimented rehearsal. 42nd Street is built, after all, not around the individual tap performer, but the chorus line, which emerged during the First World War and reflects the simultaneous industrialisation of war and militarisation of work. Let's have a little look at a bit from 42nd Street. This is a rehearsal, not a rescue. This irony, leisure and labour conjoined, is not just an accidental analogy apparent only to the irony-attuned eye of an Adorno, for it's part of the conscious mythos of tap and is time and again explicitly thematised within it. The defining dichotomy of tap dance history between Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly, the one willowy and elegantly effortless, with wrists as loose and flappy as his trousers, the other squat, thick-necked and athletically straining against his T-shirts, is really the separation of this pairing of sprezzatura and blue-collar work ethic. Sid Charisse, who paired with both of these dancers, Astaire and Kelly, summed up the difference between them when she said, "My husband always knew who I was rehearsing with when I came home at the end of the day at the studio. If I didn't have a mark on me, it was Astaire. If I was black and blue, it was Gene Kelly." I remember being struck by hearing a tap veteran many years ago saying the reason she enjoyed tap dancing was because it had more attack than other forms of dance. I was impressed by this term because, though it flaunted a certain kind of technicality, it also named something almost embarrassingly basic about tap dance, namely the huge amounts of aggression it displays and enables through its effecting of impacts and concussions. Though there are many dances in which formalised combats are acted out, there's no more immediate way of suggesting aggression than in bodily movements that mime or enact actions of striking and impact. I'm reminded of the story of Philip Larkin at a boxing match, turning to his companion and saying, "E.M. Forster was right, only connect." Much early tap dancing took the form of competitions, and the tap challenge gives tone to the sexual sparring between Astaire and Rogers that provides the unvarying template for the nine or so films they made together in the 1930s. And here's a moment of emblematic tap attack from Top Hat. But this aggression is also visible in the relation between the dancer and the world of objects, and tap is more ambivalently entangled with matter than any other form of dance I can think of. Tap dancers repeatedly duet and duel with objects, as here from a little bit earlier in the same dance. I'm going to give you another one. This is Gene Kelly's dance with a little bit earlier in the sequence in this dance from the film Summer Stock of 1950. He actually duets with a squeaky board in the floor. And then later he exploits the opportunities of newspaper. Where ballet aims to shrink and immaterialize its objects, especially the shoe, in the process metonymically disavowing the baseness of the foot, tap glorifies them both, along with the metal prostheses that from around the end of the 1920s, no one's quite sure, began to be added to it, the taps that began to be screwed into shoes. In fact, shoes themselves have not always been needed. The tradition of tap dance roller skating is perhaps initiated by this sequence from Chaplin's Modern Times in 1936. So this is imitated and given homage, I suppose, in the following year by Fred Astaire and a rather wobbly and nervous Ginger Rogers, I think, in their version of Let's Call the Whole Thing Off from Shall We Dance? All of that, I think, superbly topped by Gene Kelly in 1955 from the movie It's Always Fair Weather. Maybe tap is the first dance form to transform clumsiness into artifice without ever wholly purging that clumsiness. That sense, in Marvell's words, that mine own precipice I go. Tap is full of bungles and perilous flirtations with comically corporeal catastrophe. No matter how refined its techniques and its discourse, it can never entirely expunge its associations with the freakish, the decrepit, or the plain ridiculous. This is sometimes encoded in the contrast between the cretinously slurred shuffle that fails to break with the surly bonds of earth and the cleanly starched pizzicati of tap proper. The comedy of Wilson, Keppel, and Betty's sand dance depends a great deal, I think, upon this contrast. Betty is taking a rest in this clip. The OED rather sniffily defines tap dancing as a form of exhibition dancing characterised by rhythmical tapping of the toes and heels. Well, all forms of dancing involve some kind of exhibition, one might think, but it's certainly the case that tap dance is much more exhibitionist than other forms of dance. And the exhibition involved often suggests a kind of mild monstrosity. Remember, of course, that the word monster is related to the word demonstration, as is suggested by this scene from Mel Brooks's Young Frankenstein, in which the education of the monster is proved by his capacity to perform a sophisticated song and dance routine. Thank you. There can be few dance forms in which disability or bodily anomaly can have been so prominent, making the risible Bergsonian collision of the organic and the inorganic. In a publicity poster of 1892, one T.F. Grant was described as the champion one-legged clog dancer of the world. You could be forgiven for thinking that there would be limited competition for such a title, but you would be mistaken. Robert Stickney danced on stilts, the Purcella brothers appeared as convicts with their legs chained together, and an act called Harper and Stencil performed a one-legged double act, their amputations, one of them missing a left leg, the other a right, being complementary. The extra limb, represented by the dancer's cane and the recruitment to the dance of other parts of the body, such as hands and fingers. One performer allegedly won a tap dance contest by flipping into a handstand and patting out the finale with his palms. These reflect a certain sphinx-like uncertainty about the exact complement of limbs required to perform tap. The most astonishing exemplification of this link between impediment and tap is the career of Clayton Pegleg Bates. At the age of 12, in 1919, he caught and injured his leg in a conveyor belt in the gin mill in which he was working. His leg was later amputated on his own kitchen table. Bates, who had already been a dancer, set about relearning how to dance with one leg and built a career on Broadway in the 1930s and subsequently on TV, making more than 20 appearances on The Ed Sullivan Show, which culminated in an astonishing tap challenge with Conrad Buchner in August 1965. Bates's opening number on TV would announce, "Folks, my name is Clayton, Pegleg Bates to you. I'm always syncopating and doing something new." Here he is.
Don't look at me in sympathy. I'm glad that I'm this way. For I feel good and I'm knocking on wood as long as I can sing. I mix like fantastics or foot hot gymnastics. I'm Pegleg Bates, the one that that's next.
The matter and the mechanisms with which tap traffics are, like tap itself, noisy ones. Jerry Ames and Jim Siegelman, in their book on tap, note the relation of adversary mimicry between tap and the increasingly cacophonous material world of the 20th century. Tap dancers, they say, want to blast out and express themselves in a blatant racket. They want to fight back against the roar of jets, the boom of factories, the whir of air conditioners, the slamming of doors, the battering of jackhammers, the car horns, doorbells, telephones, stereos, barking dogs, alarm clocks, screaming babies, ambulance sirens, whistling tea kettles, and banging garbage can lids. Joel Dinerstein has placed the relation between the tap dancer and the mechanical world at the heart of his reading of popular dance in the interwar years. For Dinerstein, the tap dancer doesn't merely fight back with noise against noise, rather he transforms it, and in the process, himself. The tap dancer, Dinerstein writes, was a vision of the industrial body retooled for a rootless, immobile future. The tap dancer took the speeded-up, machine-driven tempo of life and the metallic crunch of cities and factories and spun it all into a dazzling pyrotechnical display of speed, precision, rhythmic noise, continuity, grace and power. The centrepiece of Dinerstein's analysis is the routine associated with the song Slap That Bass, from the Astaire Rogers film Follow the Fleet, which is set in the engine room of an ocean liner in which Fred Astaire is travelling to Europe in pursuit of Ginger Rogers.
Oh.
The point of the dance for Dinerstein is to show that, as he puts it, a human being is more expressively energetic than a machine. Unlike a machine, a human body can display grace, elegance, humour, surprise. I think myself there may be more reciprocity than Dinerstein allows between the human and the inhuman engines. I think we can say that if Tap spiritualizes matter, it may be with the cost and profit of a materialization of spirit. Tap dance, of course, involves a kind of musical self-accompaniment. A tap dancer busking in a doorway doesn't need a boombox to draw the attention of passers-by, because the dance provides its own soundtrack. This is one of the most striking ways in which tap seems to recall the world of novelties, stunts and exploits rather than the arts of dance. Providing your own soundtrack resembles the art of the one-man band. But if tap turns the body into an instrument, it's an acoustically very limited one. Much more limited, in fact, than most percussion instruments, despite the claim sometimes made by jazz percussionists to have listened to tap dance for new ideas. Indeed, there was a movement historically in tap away from styles that emphasised the variety of percussive sounds, both low-end and high-end sounds, scrapes, slides and shuffles, participating with stamps and ringing taps, towards a style in which the tap is reduced to ripples of dry, homogeneous clicks. And cinema participates in this, in that early sound recording techniques were in any case inadequate to pick up and reproduce much in the way of timbre or resonance. The only forms of variation that tap really permits are in amplitude and speed. You can tap louder or you can tap faster. And these two parameters seem to have an inverse ratio to one another. A loud stamp will usually slow or stop the sound, while fast passages diminish the volume. Ordinarily, to make any sound at all in dance is a kind of accident or transgression. Those who, like me, prefer to sit near the front to watch ballet in order to catch the wafts of heat and even the occasional whiff of animal effort from all that whirling and leaping are indulging a somewhat perverse desire to restore or retain the density of the body in the weightless image, apprehending the grossness of mass and matter within line and form. Those grunts and pants, the thumps of the ballerina on the boards, are corporeal sound becoming the sound of corporeality itself, which of course the dance as image must always strive to silence and sublimate. Of course, almost all dance is accompanied by sound, but in the form of music, the point of that sound being precisely to drown or displace the actual sounds of the moving body, thereby replacing accident by intention. As the theorist of film sound Michel Chillon has observed, there was almost no accidental or incidental sound in early cinema, the attention of sound engineers being focused almost exclusively on the sounds of speech, and in the case of musicals, of song and music. When trouble was taken to capture incidental sound, it almost always had a diegetic or instructive purpose, to focus the attention of the audience on some narrative element of the scene, a train pulling into a station, the blare of a siren, the clink of a glass, or the creak of a door. Sound here tends to act as a kind of acoustic captioning of significance, or as we may as well say, it captions itself as the sound of a door, a train, a busy street. And by folding hearing exactly over seeing, sound thereby double seeing, instructing the viewer, so to speak, to look at what they can see. In one sense, of course, tap conforms docilely enough to this economy, for it gives us the sound of dance, as though dance were being accorded some kind of authentically self-designating voice. Tapping seems to say, tautologically, this is dance you're seeing here. Look at all this dancing you can see. Just as the creaking door seems to say, look here at this door you can see opening. But the sound of tap is also an anomaly within this economy, I think, precisely because the only sound, as I've said, that dance is supposed to have is not endogenously made by it, but produced alongside it in the form of song or music. the sound that dance itself produces, as opposed to a sound which it accompanies, is, in every other case than tap dance, an accident or an excess. In formalising these contingencies, tap dance is, once again, the essentialising or apotheosis of bodily accident. The form of mechanism, I think, with which tap has its most insistent affinity is the semi-immaterial apparatus of cinema itself. This is most apparent in the play that tap, like cinema, effects between the divisible and the indivisible. These two principles are made to collude, in fact, in the person of a dancer like Astaire, who developed a highly distinctive blending of ballroom style, with its long, sweeping, skating curves, and tap, with its sharp angularities, chopping up those contours into their elements. Astaire aims to bring the viewer to the subliminal tipping point between these two orders as the divisible and individually audible forms of the tap come close as they're speeded up to being indiscernible. The important factor here is, of course, speed. Astaire recalled that when he was a radio tap dancer, yes, there was such a thing, for the Packard Hour in 1935, the limitations of the microphone meant that he had to perform on a mat 4 feet square, which encouraged intensity and density of taps rather than graceful and expressive movement. You couldn't actually hear the leaps. So Astaire had to provide the show's listeners with, as he puts it, a lot of taps close together, a string of ricky-ticky-ticky-tacky-tacky steps. Speed here is correlated not with movement then, but with the simultaneous condensation and agitation of place. Speed becomes a kind of principle of introversion, of an energy turning in on and regenerating from itself. Speed both thickens matter and also pushes it towards immaterialization, as in the blur of the propeller, or the illusion of matter in movement produced by the moving matter of cinema itself. For the most important feature of tap is that, for all its demonstrative extravagance, it's designed to elude or outdo the eye. This kind of deception has been at the heart of tap dance for a long time. One early tap dancer was found to have hollowed out her heels and inserted bullets into the metal-lined cavities in the heels to double up the taps. And many choreographed tap dancers escape the eye of the camera in a more literal way, since the sound of the tapping is dubbed on after the performance. Ginger Rogers' tap steps were overdubbed by one dancer called Hermes Pan, short for Panagiotopoulos, who was Fred Astaire's long-term choreographing partner. Eleanor Powell, who choreographed her own dances, like Astaire, also overdubbed them herself, not just to ensure her signature crispness of sound, but also to allow her to wear more attractive shoes, she said, than she could otherwise have done. Here is some Eleanor Powell, just because I love her. There were three stages in in the recording process. After the dance had been recorded in rehearsal, Powell would dance it silently on a mattress in the sound room while the orchestra recorded the music. This was to ensure that they were playing at the right tempo. The dance would then be filmed, with the recording being played back, But again, only for synchronization purposes, since no sound was actually recorded during the recording of the moves of the dance. And then finally, Powell would perform the dance again in a sound studio, this time on a wooden mat, so that the tap steps could be added to the recording. And the three laminations of dance, music and tap sound could be at last locked together. Actually, the question of integration or coming together is always to the fore in speaking and writing about dance numbers in Hollywood musicals. Jerome Delamater argues that the song and dance number is, as he puts it, an integration of the entire cinematic process. And yet the song always marks a more or less violent break of continuity in terms of plot, which many musicals attempt to overcome by making the characters dancers or setting the story in a theatre in which there's lots of dancing naturally going on. Fred Astaire spoke in 1937 of the challenge of smoothing out this kind of discontinuity. Excuse me, I have to whiz through to find this. In the old days, they used to cut up all the dancers on the screen. In the middle of a sequence, they would show a close-up of the actor's face or of his feet, insert trick angles taken from the floor, the ceiling, through latticework or a maze of fancy shadows. The result was that dance had no continuity. The audience was far more conscious of the camera than the dance. I've always tried to run a dance straight through in the movies, keeping the full figure of the dancer or dancers in view and retaining the flow of the movement intact. In every kind of dancing, even tap, the movement of the upper part of the body is as important as that of the legs. And so, notoriously, famously, Astaire and Rogers used to rehearse for hours and weeks and months in order that they could do the take all in one take. It would be a multi-camera setup, but it would be done all in one take. Interestingly, in another failure of synchronization, Astaire and Rogers would rehearse separately. Hermes Pan would rehearse with Ginger Rogers. He was very similar to Astaire in build and style. But tap always cuts into this kind of smooth suture, asserting the order of the discontinuous over that of the continuous. Tap is concerned not just with the world of matter, but also with the kind of materialized temporality that Henri Bergson found exemplified in the cinematographic apparatus, which he thought was a model of thinking itself. For Bergson, this materialization took the form of discontinuity introduced distortingly into what he called the suppleness and vitality of life and the inner becoming of things. Tap dance provides such a striking exemplification of this materializing discontinuity because, largely, it is so much a matter of numbers. All dance, of course, involves counting, and the greater the number of dancers in the hugely expanded chorus lines of the 1930s, for example, and the greater the intricacies of synchronization required, then the more exacting these considerations of number and quantity become. Given the way in which tap seems to produce its own accompanying soundtrack, as if it were auto-synchronizing its own movements with finite numbers of divisible beats, tap might be said to be the apotheosis of corporeal number. Itself reducible to number, it can be seen as a way of reducing contour, flow, and quality to pure quantity. More than other kinds of dance, tap is full of counting. Biographical accounts of tap dancers like Fred Astaire and Eleanor Powell emphasize the fanatical austerity of their work ethic, usually rendered in time and motion terms of the number of hours put in every day. It's apt that the most basic step in tap dance is actually known as the time step. The pursuit of dizzying speed in tap dance produced an obsession with counting. The number of taps that performers could produce at a given time were carefully logged, as though this were some kind of athletic event rather than an art form. Anne Miller, tap dancer, took on the expert typist Ruth Myers in a radio speed contest in 1946 and out-tapped her at 627 taps a minute as against Myers's measly 584. The world record for tap speed was set in 1973 and still stands by Britain's Roy Castle, who tapped at over 1,400 taps a minute, which intriguingly works out at around 24 taps a second, the same as the standard frame rate of cinema. There is no dance, I think, which corresponds as closely as tap to Walter Benjamin's characterisation of cinema as detonating what he called the dynamite of the tenth of a second. The sound of the click became ubiquitous in the early 20th century. It marked the possibility of the abrupt and absolute alternation from an off state to an on, a new experience made possible by the switch. But the click exhibited and affected the many forms of synchronicity that modern coordinated life required. The synchronized sound of the cinema comes late in the process whereby the things and the processes of the world were increasingly required to be got and to be kept, as we say, in step. But synchronicity was allied to, and maybe in a certain sense produced, its apparent opposite, namely syncopation. Synchronicity and syncopation, being on the beat and the offbeat, were themselves, as Adorno snarls, themselves synchronized. Adorno talks about the ersatz pseudo-surprises of jazz syncopation. Not only were devices and mechanisms subject to temporal regulation, they became, so to speak, timepieces. Everything told the time and kept the beat. In something like a literalisation of Bertrand Russell's explanation in his 1925 ABC of relativity, there is no longer a universal time which can be applied without ambiguity to any part of the universe. There are only the various proper times of the various bodies in the universe, which agree approximately for two bodies which are not in rapid motion, but never agree exactly except for two bodies which are at rest relatively to each other. This was the century not just of time then, but more specifically of timing. Tap required tight synchronization, but might also be seen and heard as a kind of auto-synchronization on the part of film itself. In fact, the 1930s marked the development of two devices for synchronizing sound and music that seemed to have a kind of family resemblance to tap dance. First of all, the clapperboard, whose sharp spike of sound was easily detectable, and the soundtrack, and what became known as the click track, in which holes would be punched in the optical soundtrack alongside the frame at specified intervals, so once every 24 frames would give you 60 beats per minute, which, when light shone through these holes, produced a sharp, audible click on the soundtrack. Still in use today, and in fact essential in any kind of multi-dubbing recording. For all its fierce energy, tap aligns itself with the electronic mechanisms of the second industrial revolution rather than the thumping shafts and pistons of the kinetic first. Even that engine room in which Astaire dances in Follow the Fleet seems to me more like a kind of Art Deco office than the sooty, satanic mill we might expect below decks. Tap dance is a magical transfiguration of the phenomenology of the click that became so ubiquitous in the early 20th century. It plays variations on the clicking of typewriters, of telegraphic Morse code, telephone receivers and exchanges, sewing machines, cash registers, calculators, ticker tape, and the ticking of time bombs, a word that is first recorded in print in 1893. It evokes the rattle of railway tracks, the clicking of switches and operating devices of all kinds, most notably, of course, the clicking of the camera shutter. And it anticipates the era of Geiger counters and mouse clicks. Its speed reminds us of the many forms of rotary motion that accelerate the click into the whir or the rattle, the pleasantly rasping dials of old-fashioned telephones, or in fans, propellers, or, of course, cinema projectors. The increasing commonness of precisely engineered artefacts like buttons and boxes and locks and catches that snap open and shut, and materials like plastic that click easily together, made the click come to stand for the sense of rightness or exactness of fit. W.B. Yeats wrote, for example, in 1935 that the correction of prose, because it has no fixed laws, is endless, whereas a poem comes right with a click, like a closing box. And of course, clicking can also suggest accident, maladjustment, or damage, whether in the clicks of radio interference, usually caused by the sparking of nearby electrical equipment, like the connectors of trams, or sometimes by lightning from storms very far away, or in the click of the damaged record or the broken gramophone. In this, the shufflings of tap are allotropes, as they are perhaps of the chuff, chuff, chuff of the idling gramophone we hear in Virginia Woolf's Between the Acts. And the confluence of music, timing and number is also registered in an oblique but insistent way in Joyce's novel written at the dawn of the jazz age, Ulysses, which features Tom Rochford's mechanical gadget for automatically displaying the number of a turn at the music hall for latecomers, literalising the idea of a musical number. Tom Rochford took the top disc from the pile he clasped against his claret waistcoat. "See," he said, "see, say it's turn six. In here, see, turn now on." He slid it into the left slot for them. It shot down the groove, wobbled a while, ceased, ogling them. "Six, see," he said. "See, now the last one I put in is over there. Turns over. The impact. Leverage, see?" He showed them the rising column of discs on the right. "Smart idea," Snosey Flynn said, shuffling. "So a fella coming in late can see what turn is on and what turns are over." The scene occurs in the episode known as Wandering Rocks, in which Joyce coordinates the movements across Dublin of a number of characters. Famously, he asked friends to pace out certain routes through Dublin to time them, and is said, in fact, to have written the chapter with a stopwatch at his side. In fact, the whole of Ulysses might be regarded not just as, in Eliot's famous words, manipulating a continuous parallel between contemporaneity and antiquity, but as an exercise in orchestrating complex synchronicities centred on the newspaper, that great synchronising device beloved of kidnappers. Ulysses parallels the odysseys of its two characters with the irregular passage out to sea of a flyer advertising the arrival of an evangelical preacher that Bloom screws up and tosses into the River Liffey. But it plays similar games of poo sticks with the different itineraries of persons and objects throughout the day. What's more, Ulysses might be said to feature its own version of the click track, in the regular tippings and tappings that seem to mark off the passage of time through the novel. Many of these are associated with the character of the blind stripling, whose cane is heard and imagined tapping its way through the streets of Dublin. "Queer idea of Dublin," he must have, thinks Bloom, tapping his way round by the stones. He, or rather the sound of his progress, is used to synchronise the music in the Sirens episode of the novel, in which Bloom sits in the Ormond Bar listening to music. Tap, blind, walked, tapping, by the tap, the curbstone tapping, tap by tap. In fact, 44 of the 100 or so appearances of the word tap in Ulysses occur in these rhythmic punctuations of the Sirens episode, culminating in a Lear-like sequence of 8 of them in a paragraph of its own. These sounds also modulate in the Sirens episode into the sexually predatory rat-a-tat of Blazes Boylan on the door of Bloom's home in Eccles Street. "One rapped on a door, one tapped with a knock. Did he knock? Pulled a cock with a loud, proud knocker with a cock. Cara, 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 cock, cock, cock." As well as into Bloom's milder conjugations of erotic tipping and, remembering Othello, tupping. Tipping her, he thinks, tipping her, tipping her, tapping her, topping her, tap. There's a great deal of tapping elsewhere in the novel too, including tapping with a fan, tapping with a rolled up newspaper, as well as the heel taps of Bella, dancing in the brothel. Bloom has a fondness for this elementary sound particle, using the expression tip-top, for example, repeatedly through the novel. Actually, I won't be coy, four times exactly. We all of us have electronic texts nowadays. Counting has come to the fore in our mechanised modern textuality. It's a fondness which Joyce seems to have shared, for he punctuates the text of Finnegan's Wake with the word tip, which often seems to indicate the mechanical pecking of a hen. For example, in the jaunty, jiggery-pokery rhythms of this passage, describing the unearthing of some kind of document or photograph, as it might be, the wake itself from a rubbish tip. Well, almost any photoist worth his chemicots will tip anyone asking them the teaser that if a negative of a horse happens to melt enough when drying, well, what you do get is, well, a positively grotesquely distorted macro mass of all sorts of horse-happy values and masses of melt-while horse. Tip. Well, this freely is what must have occurred to our missive. There's a sort of a turb for you. Please wisp off the grass. Unfilthed from the boucher by the sagacity of a look-me-little-like-me-long hen. Heated residence in the heart of the orange-flavoured mud mound had partly obliterated the negative to start with, causing some features palpably nearer your pecker to be swollen up most grossly, while the farther back we manage to wiggle, the more we need the loan of a lens to see as much as the hen saw. Tip. If tap dance may perhaps be regarded as another of the forms of automatism that so fascinated psychologists in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, it may also be associated with the more spasmodic kinds of click involved in the Tourette's tic. The association of dance and mania is, of course, strongly established, for example, in the epidemic of tarantella that swept across Europe in the 16th century, and in the forms of what's known as dyskinesia, or uncontrolled but rhythmical movement, characteristic of different forms of chorea, such as Sydenham's chorea or St. Vitus's dance. The word chorea, of course, means dancing. The style of grotesque dancing, as practiced by performers such as Henry Rubberlegs Williams, which involved unpredictable movements of legs and evolved into forms like the Charleston, was often called legomania, and oddly came to be associated with Russian and Hungarian dancing in the teens of the century. Although behavioural automatisms like humming, clapping and twitching of limbs have frequently been observed in epileptic seizures, it's maybe surprising that no explicit association between tapping and epilepsy has been made, until, that is, a paper of last year by a group of physicians at the Royal Hallamshire Hospital in Sheffield. They report that a 60-year-old right-handed woman with a history of temporal lobe epilepsy developed a pattern of behaviour during seizures that included, as they put it, stereotyped and extremely complex musical automatisms in the form of tap dancing. There was no social history of learned dancing. Dance had never been a hobby or pastime to any significant degree in her earlier life. There's no suggestion of elaborate routines being danced out here. The tap dancing really seems to have consisted in nothing more developed than the rhythmic leg and foot tapping. Tap dancing, by all accounts, is possessed of an energy and a joyous vitality that few other dances can match. The underlying principle of tap, says Joseph Epstein in his biography of Fred Astaire, is solely joie de vivre, simple, happy, bloody joy in living. The physical delight in dance was the thing, and to hell with the conscience of the king. But the infectiousness of this energy is a sign also of its strange rootlessness, the fact that it circulates so ceaselessly and itself energetically between and across bodies, objects, mechanisms, sounds and images, coming to rest nowhere, but passing through technologies like, and especially, like cinema. The energy of which tap is possessed possesses and dispossesses it. Tap is an image, I think, and an enactment of our manifold forms of entanglement with modern machineries of ardour, labour and delight.